World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America by shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Trout.
The Japanese at Hong Kong surrendered today, and the news has a strange ring. The Second World War, though not officially ended, has been over in the minds of most people for more than a month. This is the second month of peace. But there are still Japanese soldiers armed and in uniform in the home islands. There are still bits of the stolen empire where Japanese officials rule conquered populations. And in Hong Kong, there still were, until today, Japanese commanders who had not yet picked up the brush and painted the characters representing their names on the documents of surrender. As soon as the papers were signed in Hong Kong today, the Japanese general and admiral arose from the table, handed over their swords, and were promptly hustled off the island back to their cells on the mainland. Once the prison doors had swung shut behind the enemy representatives and the keys had been turned, the ceremonies began. The Union Jack was raised again in the courtyard of the government house, and every warship in the harbor fired a 21-gun salute. Farther north along the coast in China, Japanese troops are still swaggering through the streets of Shanghai, the great port. American correspondents there report that the Japanese forces are in control of vital utilities such as water, telephone, gas, and electric power. American Army officials say it's true the disarming of the Japanese troops is going more slowly than had been planned, but the Army officials believe the Japanese will be removed from their positions of power this coming week. But the correspondents report that the Army's assurances have not put an end to the worry and the wonder in the foreign community of Shanghai. The Japanese are said to have removed the firefighting equipment from this city, which is particularly vulnerable to fire. The water pressure has fallen below the safety level. Truckloads of heavily armed Japanese soldiers roll constantly through the streets, and Japanese transport planes land and take off, flying without Allied escort, their destinations and the identity of their passengers a mystery to the uneasy residents of Shanghai. Such is the news in the middle of this September, with the war itself passing into history, leaving behind a wreckage that can be only dimly imagined in a country untouched by shell or bomb or famine. The war is gone, but before the guns fell silent, the war had molded into a certain shape the peacetime world. This is the period of transition, the time in which the survivors must adjust themselves to the new shape of things or try to adjust the shape of the post-war world into a more desirable form. Either is an enormous job, and there's been little progress to report in the weeks that have passed since August the 14th. The United States, with more wealth than any other country, has used the past month to throw off restrictions and inconveniences. In the other major nations, restrictions and controls remain. There is no return to luxury and no prospect of an early end to sacrifice and real hardship. But here in America, after a month of swift movement back toward the freer and easier ways of peace, the storm signals are going up. Labor and management are preparing for conflict, a struggle that threatens to develop on a greater scale than any this country has ever seen, affecting the lives of even that minority of Americans who belong to neither the ranks of labor nor management. The government in Washington, which has been occupied with removing restrictions, tearing up orders and instructions, will now find itself being asked to solve the growing deadlock before the real struggle between management and labor begins. It has not yet begun, despite the alarming reports from the nation's manufacturing centers. So far, we've seen only the preliminaries. The opposing forces are moving into position for the battle. But before the battle starts, it can be averted. This is the period of transition everywhere. The decisions that are made and the actions that are taken in these days will set the course for years to come. It is not yet time to report what those decisions are. Many, perhaps the controlling ones, have not yet been made, but they cannot be delayed much longer. The pressure is mounting everywhere, and events are developing swiftly at the pace that was taught by war. In Japan, the occupation forces are steadily strengthening their grip. And now our first report from abroad. for a recorded report by CBS correspondent William J. Dunn in Tokyo, Admiral takes you to San Francisco.
Ever since the first American troops landed on Japanese soil more than 2 weeks ago, radio and newspaper correspondents have virtually exhausted their normal store of adjectives in the effort to portray something of the picture to the outside world. Amazing, unbelievable, astounding, fantastic, incredible. Those were just a few, and apparently they were too few. Earlier this evening, another correspondent walked into my room to show me a wire from his home office, asking for reaction of soldiers who had met the Japanese in combat toward the Japanese people, explaining that those reactions should be of great interest, although probably unprintable. We have plenty of those soldiers here in Japan right now. Members of the 1st Cavalry Division, the 11th Airborne, the 43rd, the 27th, to name a few, all of whom have met the Jap in bitterest combat, who know how he fights, and what kind of a man he is in uniform. And their attitude toward the Japanese people? That's one of the things that's amazing, astounding, incredible, unbelievable, and all the rest. The American soldier is a friendly guy, and there's nothing he can do about it. It's not possible for him to shove civilians around. He can't help saying thank you for favors offered, even though he may be suspicious of those favors down in his heart.
That was William J. Dunn in Tokyo. Earlier today, John Adams broadcast a report from Manila on plans to return American troops from the Philippines. Here is John Adams' recorded report.
In the Philippines today, there are two kinds of GIs, those who are waiting to go to Japan and those who are waiting to go home. They all want to go home, but those without the demobilization attributes of age and point are resigned to the fact that they still face many months of Army of Occupation work in Japan or along the China coast or in Korea before they sail through the Golden Gate or other ports of debarkation. The Philippines have proven to be the principal supply pool for occupation troops, with 6 of the 10 units already in Japan and Korea having staged from the Philippines, and the other 4 from Okinawa. There are an additional 13 units now in the process of staging from the Philippines, General MacArthur revealed in Tokyo yesterday. These are almost entirely battle-hardened divisions who have not only fought through the 10-month-long Philippine campaign, but have been engaged in the many battles along General MacArthur's long road back from Melbourne to Tokyo. These earmarked divisions include the 6th, the 24th, 25th, 32nd, 33rd, 40th, 41st, 77th, and 81st, as well as the 158th Regimental Combat Team and elements of the 10th, 11th, and I Corps. These troops will be staging from Leyte, Panay, Mindanao, Cebu, and Luzon, together with hundreds of thousands of tons of supplies, equipment, and food, which had originally been shipped here as part of the invasion requirements. Many of these divisions have had a pretty complete turnover since they sailed from the States over 3 years ago, although there are still plenty of GIs and officers who have fought through every campaign. Replacements have been pouring into the Philippines during the last 6 months to replace the battle casualties and those who went home on rotation and those who are waiting to go home on age or point. But the homeward-bound boats seem to be moving pretty slowly these days, especially for those GIs who have been in it from the beginning. It's usually good-natured griping, and in recent weeks they have quickly accepted the explanation that some of their ships are presently required to send home thousands of liberated prisoners of war and internees who have had a far tougher time than they have in the Jap prison camps. But there is more than one oldster I've talked with, those over 35 years of age, who are wondering if they are being kidded with recent published reports that all men over 35 with 2 or more years service were eligible for discharge. They heard about it on September 2nd, and today's issue of the Army newspaper, the Daily Pacifican, printed a new batch of protest letters from the GIs asking for an explanation. The Pacifican editor checked with the AG's office and reported that no official word had yet been received in this theater from Washington authorizing release of 35-year-olds. This is John Adams in Manila.
You have heard Columbia correspondents William J. Dunn in Tokyo and John Adams in Manila. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney. Current surveys show a majority of music lovers want a radio phonograph with an automatic record changer. And well-informed buyers will choose an Admiral, America's smart set, because of the foolproof, service-free operation of the famous Admiral automatic record changer. You'll get faster record changing. The new Admiral changes records in just 5 seconds. The 1946 Admiral changer has only 3 moving parts during the change cycle. This means you'll get a trouble-free mechanism and longer service from your record changer. You'll like the high fidelity and lifelike tone of the new Admiral sets. And a newly designed featherlight tone arm exerts so little pressure that longer record life and less surface noise are assured. So, if you want a radio phonograph with the best of everything for your listening pleasure, you'll buy the product of the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. You'll buy an Admiral, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Robert Trout. Next, the news from Britain. Admiral takes you to London. Charles Collingwood reporting.
The Council of Foreign Ministers is finding the solution of Europe's problems heavy going. If anyone thought that the reshaping of the world after this war was going to be a simpler process than it was after the last, this Conference of Foreign Ministers, which to a great extent is taking the place of the Versailles Peace Conference, is proving them wrong. The foreign ministers went into the conference in general agreement on the principle that Italy should be granted generous peace terms. Two subordinate problems remain to be solved. The first was Italy's frontiers in Europe, where both France and Austria demand the territory, but where the Yugoslav claims to Trieste are the touchiest point. The second outstanding problem was the disposition of Italy's former colonies in Africa. Yesterday, the ministers decided to refer the question of Italy's colonies to their deputies. The deputies are supposed to make their recommendations 2 weeks before the next meeting of the foreign secretary, so that problem is a long way from solution. As for Italy's European borders, they begin discussion on that tomorrow, with Yugoslavia and Italy presenting their claims, and Australia, Canada, India, and everyone else who is interested, including Poland, the Ukraine, and White Russia, presenting their views. The Italian foreign minister, Signor Gasperi, left Rome for London today, and so did Ambassador Alexander Kirk, the United States representative in Rome. After what is bound to be a long debate on this, this problem, too, will probably be turned over to the foreign minister's deputies. This meeting of the foreign ministers got off to a slower start than most people, including perhaps the ministers themselves, expected. Much of this is due to what in the army would be called bad staff work. The most ordinary, foreseeable problems, like translation and procedure, had to be worked out on the spot by the foreign ministers themselves instead of having been done in advance. That is probably because most of the ministers are new to high-level international conferences. But it means that almost nothing will be settled at this meeting. Just as the chiefs of state referred these problems to their foreign secretaries at Potsdam, so here in London the foreign secretaries will refer them to their deputies. The final solution are still months away. This is Charles Collingwood in London, returning you to Admiral Radio in New York.
In this country, Congress appears intent on asking more questions about the demobilization programs of the armed services. For this and other news, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
The Truman administration is expected to move swiftly this week to divert the mounting tide of criticism over demobilization of the armed forces. President Truman is between the devil and the deep blue sea. As the chief executive, he must see to it that the United States has enough armed forces to live up to its international commitments. He must accept the word of his generals on this score. This puts Harry Truman on an uncomfortable spot. for now he must support to the hilt some of the same generals he criticized so caustically as head of the famous investigating committee. As head of the Democratic Party, President Truman must prevent the opposition from capitalizing on the popular resentment against the brass hats. The Republicans will force the issue in the House this week. The Democratic majority of the House Military Committee has bottled up the bill to halt inductions and speed up releases from the armed services. The president is said to feel that a few new faces in the War Department may help, both to calm ruffled feelings and to sell the idea of a strong Army and Navy in peacetime. The stories circulating in Washington today say that we will have a new Secretary of War and Chief of Staff within a very short time. It is reported that the president will replace elder statesman Henry L. Stimson as Secretary of War with dynamic Judge Sherman Minton. Judge Minton is an old senatorial crony of the president and a close personal friend. The only question seems to be whether Judge Minton feels he is in good enough health to take on this big assignment. The judge, incidentally, was in Washington most of last week and spent some time over at the Pentagon. The other change would be to replace one of America's most popular heroes. It would be to bring in one of America's most popular heroes, General Ike Eisenhower, to replace General George C. Marshall as Chief of Staff. With this team, the president is said to feel he could resolve the basic issue of how big a post-war Army-Navy we are to have and gain wide public acceptance. Minton speaks the language of Capitol Hill and is respected there. Eisenhower is perhaps the most universally popular man in our Army. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Now for a summary of the developments holding the attention of France. Admiral takes you to CBS Paris. Douglas Edwards reporting.
There are reports in Paris this afternoon that the French government is about to lodge a strong protest with China because Chinese General Liu Hong has told the French military mission it will not be allowed to enter Indochina at this time. According to the story, the thing caused quite a stir in Paris official circles. General Liu Hong is understood to have told the French that French sovereignty has not been recognized in Indochina yet, and Paris circles believe the Chinese stand is contrary to agreements already reached between Paris and Chongqing. It'll be interesting to watch what transpires now. Perhaps an omen of darker days to come were events in Paris and Toulouse at market time yesterday. Hundreds of housewives, angered at exorbitant prices, looted poultry shops and groceries and carried away all they could lay their hands on. By the time police arrived, they'd mayrayed with a large quantity of meat and chickens. There's also been an increasing number of strikes throughout France in the last 24 hours, all for wage raises. Public offices in Lille were closed yesterday, and there were threats of long walkouts in the mines unless wage demands are met. Delegations are en route to Paris. With the elections nearing, there's been a marked step-up in political discussions in France today. Here's one observation I've heard several times lately, the last from the editor of a Lyon newspaper, a cousin of former President Ariel. He said France regards de Gaulle as the symbol of her liberation, the real spark that brought warmth again into the French national spirit. If de Gaulle were content to remain a symbol as President of the Republic, said he, well and good. But if he continues to make a fight for personal power, that's not so good. As the editor put it, France has had too many unhappy experiences with a soldier at the helm, and he mentioned Napoleon as not being a despot at the beginning. He was in hopes de Gaulle would keep in the background and turn politics over to a politician. And this is Douglas Edwards in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
In Tokyo, Supreme Headquarters announced today that General MacArthur lodged a strong protest with the Russians who shot down an American super fortress over northern Korea, and that the Russians subsequently apologized for the mistake. The text of the protest over the incident, which occurred on the 29th of August, was not disclosed, but headquarters in Tokyo said its language was strong and gave this account of it. The super fort was flying over Russian-controlled Korea when Russian fighter planes intercepted it and, by signals, attempted to force it to land at a nearby airfield. The big bomber headed toward the sea, and the fighters once again tried to force it to land. And then they made a third pass, shooting out an engine, and the pilot ordered the crew to bail out. The report from Tokyo said that all members of the crew escaped. General MacArthur's protest pointed out that the super fort was obviously an American plane and had been shot down after the Japanese had been ordered to cease fire and to keep all their planes grounded. The protest was filed a few days after the incident, and the Russians replied that the shooting was to be regretted. It was a mistake, but Russian flyers knew that some Japanese planes still were in the air, and the Russians said their pilots thought the Japanese might have repaired a super fort forced down in Japan, and they were taking no chances. The Italian foreign minister has left Rome for the Council of Foreign Ministers meeting in London. And now, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
The Italian foreign minister, De Gasperi, left by plane today for London to take part in the peace talks at the Big Five Powers Conference. A headline in a Rome paper says, De Gasperi leaves for London to defend Italy's rights over Venezia Giulia. Trieste and Venezia Giulia are the issues that are focusing the greatest attention here. Of all the major Italian parties, only the communists have failed to take a clear stand on Trieste. With that exception, the parties are unanimous about Italy's eastern frontier, including Trieste, and the Italian seaboard towns of western Istria. The Italian delegation to London will undoubtedly claim those towns along with a certain hinterland behind them. These seaboard towns below Trieste are now occupied by Yugoslav troops. They are on Marshal Tito's side of the hastily drawn Morgan Line, which divides the Anglo-American and Yugoslav zones of occupation. In an interview in a Rome paper today, the Italian Prime Minister Parri gives his view on the Morgan Line. He rejects it as one of the most irrational and inhuman lines ever devised for Italy's eastern borders. No Italian government, he adds, could feel that it had sufficient strength or authority to give approval to that line. But there are many signs that the Italians are ready to compromise. Prime Minister Parri, in his interview, refers to the purely Slav territory of northern Venezia Giulia. Most Italians, and probably the government too, are prepared to accept an international regime for Trieste port, with the cultural and domestic administration of the city remaining Italian. It is true that the Rome press has often taken an emotionally nationalistic line when speaking of Trieste, but the government, at least, seems to be approaching the problem in a sober and statesmanlike spirit. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
The tropical hurricane, gradually losing its force but still dangerous, is moving northward in Florida today after crossing the southern part of the state and devastating the Richmond Naval Air Station. Apparently, the storm is headed toward the Atlantic coast between Daytona Beach and Jacksonville. A few hours ago, the Miami Weather Bureau said the storm center probably will emerge into the Atlantic Ocean tonight, as it's expected to begin a north-northeast or a northeastward movement soon. Previously, it had been moving up the west coast of Florida, and it appears likely to head back across the state. And now to tell you about an electric refrigerator with all the latest features for better food preservation, here is Warren Sweeney.
It's Dual Temp by Admiral. It won't be long till many of you will be deciding on your next electric refrigerator. So let me briefly go over the exclusive features of the Admiral Dual Temp for you. You know, Admiral Dual Temp is really two refrigerators in one. Dual Temp is a refrigerator with a built-in freezing locker that will actually quick freeze meats, fruits, and vegetables and store nearly two bushels of frozen food safely for months. Then, in the Admiral Dual Temp, there's the huge moist cold compartment where foods stay fresh and moist in uncovered dishes. And you never have to defrost it. There just aren't any frost-collecting coils to defrost. You can readily see that with no coils, there is more storage space for foods, too. You will like the amazing Stirilamp in your Admiral Dual Temp. Stirilamp's ultraviolet ray action kills bacteria, retards mold growth, and neutralizes offensive odors. So, when you're deciding on your next electric refrigerator, remember these Admiral Dual Temp features. A built-in freezing locker, a huge moist cold compartment with no defrosting and no covered dishes. Stirilamp protection against food spoilage. You can read all about these Admiral Dual Temp features if you'll write for a free copy of a new full-colored booklet called It's a Promise from Admiral. Just write your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral at this station. Just write your name and address, Mail to Admiral. The farmers of America need help this year in harvesting the food crop so vital to the well-being of the world. Men and women and older boys and girls who can help on a part-time basis should do so. If you can help on weekends or for one day a week or for a longer period, your help is greatly needed. To get the information you want, contact your county agent or local farm employment office. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you